This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina has been mired in the Great Recession for years. Although we were late coming into it, we've also been lagging the rest of the nation in our recovery. Unemployment remains an issue, a big one, but one which eluded the political conversation in the state during the last election. But now, at least in terms of the economy at large, the clouds seem to be parting and some sunlight is trying to force its way through. Dr. John Connaughton is a UNC Charlotte economist and director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, the state's official economic forecast. He sees modest growth in 2013. And the key word there isn't modest, it's growth, since it's been a while since that word has been used in the same sentence as North Carolina. After years of bringing us quarterly doom and gloom, Dr. Connaughton has been summoned here today to explain this shocking reversal of fortunes. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike. Yeah, I understand the problem getting the words out. It's been 5.5 years, so I can appreciate that.
Pull that microphone a little closer.
All right, here we go.
John likes to sit back. He's so comfortable doing this show because he does it every quarter, and you know. And today you have a smile on your face, which bodes well. So the good news is that you are forecasting a moderate growth rate in North Carolina of 1.5% in 2013, which to me sounds small. So what makes it moderate?
Well, it's a tale of two economies, if you will. The first half of the year, we don't think it's going to be all that good. We'll struggle a little bit, and that's mainly because of what's transpired in the last couple of months. One, we had the tax increase on January 1st. Social Security tax holiday was not continued. We lost $105 billion out of consumer pockets as a result of that. We had tax increase where part of the Bush tax cuts were not extended. That was another $50 billion. And on March 1st, we got sequestration, which is $85 billion of tax, spending cuts. And you can total that all up and you get $240 billion of reduced spending, either from consumers or by government. And that's going to really hurt us in the first half of the year as we adjust to that. The second half of the year, however, things look much, much brighter. And we actually think that the second half of the year will actually approach 3% growth in those two quarters. Mm. And that'll be quite a difference to have two quarters in a row with that level of growth.
So compare this 1.5% and later on this year, the possible 3% growth to what we had pre-recession.
3% growth is about our long-term average, maybe a little bit over 3% growth. But I think that what it's signaling is really the beginning of a more normal economy probably in 2014 and 2015. The reason that we're looking a little bit optimistic is that for the first time in over 5 years, we're starting to see some activity in the housing market. And that's an important aspect of the economy. You're not going to have the kind of recovery that you expect to get out of a recession unless the housing market participates. That's really the bottom line.
And by that, you mean new construction?
Absolutely new construction. Resales, I mean, they do a little bit for real estate agents, but it is the new construction when you're building a $200,000 or $300,000 house that generates a lot of jobs and a lot of activity. And we really haven't had any of that in the last 5 years.
But given our unemployment rate, which rose again in January by a tick, given that, the need for new construction, it seems to me, is driven by growth. It's driven by incoming population. And if there's no job, to come to, why would you come
here? It's driven by a number of things, okay, Mike. It's not just simply that the economy is doing well. It's also driven by the supply side. And there are two things that we have put together that suggest this change, if you will, sea change in the second half of the year. Number one, we've seen a real dramatic decline in inventory of new housing. Typically, you look in good times at 6-7 months. At the peak of this recession, when the housing market was in shambles, we had 14 months of new supply, which basically means at current sales rates that it'd take 14 months to get rid of inventory. If you've got that much inventory, think of a car dealer that's got 14 months worth of inventory at current sales rates. He's not going to order any more cars. Well, builders aren't going to build any more houses. Right. In the last couple of months, we've seen that inventory level come down to 4 months supply, which means if they don't start changing the rate at which they're building homes and building them and change that rate pretty quickly, they're going to run out of things to sell, and it's hard to sell. And builders are smart. When they get down to 4 months supply, which is below the kind of the long-term average, they're going to start to ramp up construction.
Because it's hard to sell an empty lot.
Absolutely.
People have no vision.
Yeah.
They want to walk through the house.
They want to walk through the house at least halfway complete and get a sense as to how it's going to feel. We're visual people. So that's one part of it. So that's really been a fundamental change. We haven't seen that at any time in the last 5 years during this cycle that we've gotten down to this level at all. So that's number one. Number two, in the last year, January to January, we've seen the home prices of houses rise nationally by about 7.3%. Charlotte, which is the only market in North Carolina that's tracked by the Schiller Index, was up about 5.5% in terms of housing price. This creates a psychological change in the way consumers think. For the past five and a half years, consumers have realized that they don't need to buy the house now. If they wait a month or two or 3 months, 6 months, whatever, the price will be less. That's a better deal from them. And so they just sit back and they don't do anything. Mm-hmm. Well, now as the information starts to get to consumers that, wait a minute, housing prices are rising, and if you wait, that house is going to cost 5% more next year or 7% more next year, it motivates them to, if they're in the market for a house, to go ahead and buy now. So you'll see a ramp up in demand as a result of the psychological change, moving from a time of deflation in housing prices to a time of inflation in housing prices.
And I guess the good news there is even as housing prices are going up, the Fed's keeping the interest rates low, and so your interest rate on your loan is going to be at historic lows.
Absolutely. I mean, we're looking now at 3.5% for 30-year fixed money, and with the Fed, the statement that they made earlier this week where they're going to continue to do this kind of quantitative easing for at least another year and change.
Right.
Buying $85 billion worth of bonds per month, you know, it signals that now is the time. If you're going to buy a house,
now's the time.
Now is the time.
You already missed the real window of opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, but there's more certainty now in terms of what's going to happen with your housing price. Another reason that people don't want to buy houses when the prices are going down is because they buy a house and, you know, 6 months later it's worth
less.
Yeah, less than what they paid for it, and they feel very, very badly about that.
So you're predicting a growth of 1.7% in the first quarter and the second quarter. Third quarter is expected to grow at 2.9% and the fourth quarter at 2.8%, an upward trend, but they don't add up to
1.5%. Yeah, so that's a quirk of that's a quirk of remember when we do the quarterly outlooks or the quarterly numbers, they're at annualized rates.
Yeah.
When we talk about the annual growth rate for the year, it's kind of the average of the year versus the average of last year. So it's really, think about it, it's a July to July number.
So if you're right about the second half.
And what we had was a decline in the second half economy in 2004. So we went down again from where we were in July. So part of what we're doing is getting back to where we were in July. That's why the rate's a little bit lower.
So if things turn out the way you believe they will, and the second half of the year seems to be performing at almost pre-recession levels, what will that mean? What will that feel like to the average person listening to us today?
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, just in terms of we did the forecast and we released it last week. Since that time, there was the annual two-year benchmarking of the employment numbers for states. That's something that the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, does every other year. Mm-hmm. And so we moved from the 2011 benchmark where they take – because remember, that all these numbers are survey numbers. They're based on a sample. And they also collect more complete information, not quite a census, but more complete information with a bigger sample. And they make that benchmarking every 2 years so that the two line up. In the benchmarking, what we saw was actually job growth was a little bit better than we thought it was in 2012. Instead of 70,000, 72,000, it turned out to be about 85,000. And next year, based on this new benchmarking and the jobs were created last year, we think we'll probably be doing about another 80,000 jobs this year in 2013. So that by the end of the year, December to December, 12 to 13, add about another 80,000 jobs. It's not quite the number we want in the state. We would like to see 100,000. That would be the number that we'd be shooting for. But 80,000 is much better than what we've been experiencing in the last several years. So what people are going to see is basically job growth. And what that's going to mean is that people are going to start to feel more comfortable. And when people start to feel more comfortable, we'll see and I think this is really going to start to happen in the second half of the year when we get a lot of this politics behind us, which will pretty much all be done by May. In the second half of the year, what we're going to start to begin to see is consumer confidence changing. And that's been a real problem for the last 5 years. Every month, the Conference Board comes out with their survey, which is an estimate of consumer confidence. It's an index number. The normal is 90. We've been tracking in the 60s. And I think last month we just made it to 70. If we can start to see that consumer confidence rise because consumers feel a bit more comfortable about the future of the economy, up to about 80, 85, an index number, then I think we're really ready for 2014 to maybe take off. So I think that the second half of this year for consumers and for just regular people, it's going to start to feel like, oh, this is what it used to be like.
Keep talking. Yeah. So what used to be like. Given you think that job growth may continue to rise, although it was below normal we had unemployment go up in January, but you see that as we go through the second half of the year, unemployment will lower, more jobs will be created. How long will it take to get back to pre-recession job numbers?
That's going to take a long time. Right now, we're sitting at 9.5%. That's the new January number for North Carolina. It makes us the fifth worst state in the nation in terms of unemployment rate. We're in the company of states like Nevada, California, Michigan, Illinois. I mean, those are New Jersey. Those are the states that are around us that have these same high unemployment rates. We've been there for the last 2 years. And despite the fact that 2013 is going to look a little bit better, it's going to look a little bit better most everywhere. Our relative ranking in terms of unemployment isn't going to change very much. I think the unemployment rate will come down. It'll be below 9% by the end of the year, but just barely below a high 8% range, 8.8, something like that, 8.8. We lost, again, these are new benchmark numbers. We lost 334,000 jobs. We've gained back a little over 200,000 of those jobs. So we still got another 140,000, 130,000 more jobs to go before we get back to where we were in 2007 in terms of our job numbers. And that means that's just getting back to where we were, but the state's population has grown in the last 5 years. And, you know, more people want jobs. And so we haven't even begun to start to fill the gap between, you know, how many jobs we have to grow to accommodate the increase in the labor force and the population. And so before we get that unemployment rate, even if we get 2013, the second half, good, 2014, again, a replay of the second half of 2013, it's going to take another 4 years before we start to see the unemployment rate back down into the 5% range. Mm.
I'm going to come back to jobs a little bit later on in the conversation, but there are continued problems in Europe, and just this week, Cyprus toyed with the idea of taxing deposits, which sent Europe and Russia into a frenzy, and we even saw our stock market, which is on a tear, drop a little bit for a couple of days.
You know, it's when you sit away from it and you look at time after time with the European Central Bank, the ECB, with these bailouts, and you know they try one thing in Spain, they try another thing in Ireland, and after a while you get to realize that these folks probably don't have a clue as to what they're doing. And I mean that with some degree of respect, but I think that this idea of a unified Eurozone with a common currency across 17 countries is probably an idea that wasn't really well thought out. It was instituted. It's been there for 20 years, but 20 plus years. But I don't think that it's actually going to survive. Listen, this was the dumbest idea I have heard in the last 5.5 years of economic trouble.
What, taxing deposits?
Taxing deposits. So let me explain to you what.
You have to hold.
Okay.
Because we have to take a break. And I want to ask you more about this euro thing, because why isn't it like the dollar in the United States? We'll find out your take on that in a second. We're coming right back. Dr. John Connaughton, our guest, the Babson Capital Economic Forecast Director. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Graduate School at UNC Charlotte, offering more than 100 graduate programs in fields like business, health, education, and engineering. Information at evenhighereducation.uncc.edu. And Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at 800-715-2286. Now, you thought the guy behind the bar was just a bartender, but no. In this day and age of specialization, he or she is a mixologist. And on our next food show, that's right, our food show, we belly up to the bar to explore the rising interest in cocktail making. It's now being taught in culinary schools, and there is a science to mixing a drink. So we will find out more. We break out the tumblers and the ice tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Cyprus seeks alternatives after rejecting European bailout terms. How the financial crisis in Cyprus tests Germany, the European Union, and world markets.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. John Condon is our guest from the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte, the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. We're talking about some of the bumps in the road, off the air and on the air, particularly with regard to the economy and what's going on in Europe and the Eurozone, and this last little bump, which was Cyprus floating the idea of taxing deposits, which got Russia in a tizzy because a lot of their companies put money in Cyprus for the same reason our companies put money in the Caymans. And it even had repercussions here in our stock market.
Yeah, as I've said when we're getting ready to go to break, this is probably in the 5 years of this economic calamity worldwide, this is probably the dumbest idea I've heard. And let me try to explain why that's the case. First of all, we need to understand this isn't a tax on the increased tax on the interest you earn on your accounts. This is a tax on the balance on the accounts. Okay.
So overall, the balance is disappearing.
Yeah, it's a wealth tax. Yeah. And it's as much as 10%, which means it'll wipe out 10% of your accumulated earnings over your lifetime. And they always point to the fact in Cyprus, well, you know, there are a lot of rich Russians that are in there, so who the heck cares, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But really, we have to – it's more complicated than that. Number one, banks rely on confidence that when you come to get your money, it's going to be there. It's fractional reserves banking system. They never actually have 100%. They've got more like 20% of deposits on hand in the form of cash. Banks are susceptible to runs, and banks cannot, and this is a very important point, banks cannot sustain a run. So when people come and want their money, we saw what happened in 2008 in Wachovia. They had a run on the bank, and eventually it had to be taken over and fire sailed, in this case, to Wells Fargo. Probably worked out fairly well for Charlotte that Wells bought it, but nevertheless, that's what a run will do. Now, I want you to think about if this tax goes through, and all of a sudden, Cyprus confiscates 10% of your bank account, if you have a Cyprus bank account. Mm-hmm. And this is in the EU. Think about the people who have money in banks in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland, where these financial systems and governments are in trouble. What do you think rational people are going to do?
Take their money out of the bank.
They're going to take their money out of the bank. These banks cannot – no bank – not just in Portugal, Spain, Ireland, no bank, not in the United States, nowhere can they sustain a run on the bank. It'll collapse the financial system. So, you know, while
– and that is because they've taken the money you've – deposits are liabilities.
That's right.
They've taken the money that you've put in and they've lent it out.
That's right. So
they have to call in the loans.
If you put $1,000 in a checking account or a savings account, they may keep $200 of it as what we call required reserves. The other $800 is in some other form of an asset. Whether it's a loan that may be have a term on it, not necessarily callable. It may be in a treasury bond. It may be in new home construction financing. But they don't have access to it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, normally that 20%, that $200 is more than enough to cover the activity, you know, at any given time in that checking account, the liability that they have. But if everybody decides it's just like A Wonderful Life, folks watch that on Christmas, this is basically A Wonderful Life. If people start to show up at it was a Bailey building and start wanting their money, he doesn't have the money. It's all tied up in the houses that are around here. So, you know, that's the reality of this. I mean, it's almost like a total misunderstanding of exactly the confidence that's required in a banking system by the ECB. It's absolutely bizarre. I don't think there's a single – this is one of those cases, you know, when you have economists on the one hand but on the other. I don't think this is one of these cases where you could find an economist anywhere who'd think this was a good idea.
So why would they do it? Surely they have economists at their disposal to advise them on things they should do and not do and
but
things
they
should
don't
say
listen.
And not say.
Yeah.
Are they in that much trouble that this was the last resort they had to go there?
I think that
they backed off on it, haven't they?
The ECB hasn't backed off.
Okay.
So, you know, what you're looking at is 55 legislators in a country of 1.1 million that are being put in a position to basically save the European banking system. It's kind of ludicrous when you think about it. But, you know, their initial response was to vote against it. There were a majority vote against it, and the rest were basically abstentions. There wasn't a single vote for it in the Cypriot legislature. So the question then becomes, what will be the modified plan? They've talked about a higher threshold before they confiscate. And believe me, this is confiscation. This isn't a tax. This is a confiscation of wealth. So they're talking about a higher threshold before they step in, and maybe a lower rate with some participation from the Russians in order to help them and bail out their banking system. But at the end of the day, what's happened is that the ECB is not going to support Cyprus banks. And it seemed to make that clear. And I think it's for political reasons back in Northern Europe, France and Germany, where they believe the body politic there believe that they're being asked to bail out these ne'er-do-well southern European neighbors, if you
will. Is that the problem? And the euro seemed to do good things for Europe and the countries involved in the euro for a long time, but that long time coincided with good economic times. So is the problem the fact that this is not a country, this is a collection of countries, each with their own political systems, and a lot of tensions that have historically existed between among those countries for centuries.
You know, this is funny, Mike, and it's interesting you raise this, because just before this great recession began, there was a great deal of talk that the euro would replace
the dollar
as the international currency. I don't think that's going to come up ever again. And the question is whether the euro will last the next decade. There's a fundamental disconnect in the design of the euro. And that is that in the United States, we have a monetary and a fiscal authority. Now, one of them is Congress, one of them is the central bank. But, you know, they talk to one another. Bernanke is required by law to testify before Congress, and we are able to coordinate. I know it seems bizarre now because Congress can't get along, but in normal times, we're able to coordinate our monetary and fiscal policy. That's not the case in Europe. You've got a central bank Luxembourg that essentially defines monetary policy for the 17 countries that are on the euro, and you have 17 individual fiscal policy, 17 individual bank commissions that control the banks. It's just a disjointed system. It's a lot worse than what we have in the United States with the states. But the bottom line here is that in the United States, if push comes to shove, and, you know, we hope this never ever has to happen, but if push comes to shove and a country, and this country gets in trouble and has to bail out its banking system for whatever reason, and it can't borrow the money to do it, which is what's problem in Greece and Spain. They can't borrow no money to help bail out their banking system, but the ECB. At the end of the day, we could print the money to do that. Now, it would devalue the currency, and it would be a loss of wealth as a result of that. But at the end of the day, we can do that, and everybody knows that we can do that, and a sovereign country can do that. In effect, what we've created is a eurozone that does not have essentially 17 sovereign countries. Hmm. It's got a hybrid system. The question ultimately is, will this last? Will they do enough damage to the economy of Europe? Because now I think most of the countries are in full-blown recession, have been during the second half of 12. This additional crisis in Cyprus is suggesting that 2013 is not going to be a whole lot better for them.
And how big a drag are their troubles on our economy in this country and here in Charlotte? We have a lot of German companies here,
right,
other companies from other countries.
Yeah, the two things. One is the answer to the first part of the question, how much a drag is that on our U.S. economy? And the answer there is Europe – in the eurozone, mm-hmm. collectively, is our largest trading partner. So we lose a lot of export sales, but we've already suffered that. That's already happened. Our export sales have gone down as a result of the eurozone being in recession. So that's already taken place. It's not going to get any worse in 2013 than it was in 2012, I don't think. It'll just be at that kind of anemic level. So that's one thing that's going on. So we've already really suffered that export loss. Second thing is, you're talking about the German companies that are here. One of the things about Germany is that they don't rely on domestic German consumption, or for that matter, even European consumption. Germany is fundamentally an export-oriented country, an export-oriented industrial structure. Those companies that are here are servicing predominantly the North American market. And so it is products that they make that they do better than anyone else in the world, and they just make them here. It's like BMW. I mean, they opened that SUV factory here primarily because this is the biggest SUV market in North America.
Why ship them when you can
make them here?
Let's talk about some of the other things that affect us. The fiscal cliff that we faced at the end of the year, which was going to be disastrous if we went over it. They voted at the last possible minute to make sure that we didn't go over it. Now we have the sequester, which has kicked in, and we're told that it will be horrible. It's going to be so horrible that we couldn't even contemplate it, so it would never happen. But now it's happened, and they say it's going to phase itself in over time. So these two things put together, what's the impact, and what will the impact be if, with as the sequester rolls out and start and things start getting cut?
Okay, back to the numbers we talked about earlier: $105 billion in Social Security tax holiday going away, $50 billion in some of the Bush tax cuts not being expended, $85 billion in sequestration cuts of federal spending. Sum total, it's about $240 billion. It's about 1.5% of GDP. That's why GDP is going to grow at 1.5% in the first half of the year. I mean, that's basically the drag it puts on the economy. But as the economy grows, we will be able to absorb that $240 billion. So over time, that $240 billion one-time kind of a ratchet cut down, if you will, goes away. It doesn't change the trend line. It just changes, makes a ratchet in the trend line. It kind of shifts it down. So if you picture a 45-degree or just a – yeah, just for the sake of argument, in a graph, picture a 45-degree line going upward.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, just think about a break in the second half of that line just kind of shifts down by $240 billion, but it continues on the same trajectory. Yeah, it takes about half a year to basically get back to where you were before. So
had it not been for the fiscal cliff and the sequestration, if they had come to some agreement like adults, what would your forecast look like for North Carolina this year?
Well, it depends on what kind of an agreement. I mean, this is a better agreement than had they not come to any agreement whatsoever. If we looked at the fiscal cliff numbers, it wasn't 1.5% of GDP. It was more like 2.9% of GDP with everything that we were looking at if it had happened on January 1st. That would have been enough to send us in recession. This is just enough to basically have us take a breath. All right. And so that's why the first half of the year looks a little weak. But, and here's the big part, the big but in all this. I mean, what we talked about earlier with the housing market, if we start to see housing construction pick up like we expect it's going to, it's going to dwarf this tax increase and the sequestration. It's going to dwarf it. Housing historically was around 5%, new residential construction was about 5% of GDP. We're now less than 4% of GDP in new housing construction. We pull out that 1%, put it back into the economy, and it's the difference between a 2% growth rate and a 3% growth rate. It's just almost that simple. And so this really, the second half of this year really does depend on this housing market, new construction recovery.
So we have these two things from Washington going on, and then we have rising fuel prices. They've gone up about 50 cents a gallon.
40 cents a gallon since December.
Well,
and they're starting to come back down again.
You burn regular, don't you? It's starting to come back down. But what impact does that have? It's $100 billion?
It's not quite. That's about $80 billion for 50 cents. So if you take 40 cents, it was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 billion. $65 billion. It hurts. There's no question about it. However, a couple of things have changed in the calculus of that over the year. Number one, we see this virtually every single first quarter of the year. This is not unusual. And by the second quarter, by August, it'll be back down to where it was in December, most likely. This has been a pattern. This is caused not by the price of petroleum, price of a barrel of oil. This is caused because of refining switchovers that start to take place in January and February when environmental rules click in and different parts of the country require different mixes than what they needed in the wintertime. All right. And so refineries are having to switch over, and there's some downtime. And we have a very, you know, we're very tight on refining capacity in this country. And we haven't built a new refinery in over 20 years here. We've expanded some refineries, but we're still very, very tight on refining capacity.
And why haven't we built new refineries?
Yeah. That's a whole show and a half, and beyond my expertise. But, but as a result of that, you know, whenever we have this switch over to more environmentally friendly fuels that we use in the summertime, there's this kind of a ramp up in prices to kind of deal with the temporary shortfall in supply. And this will be gone, as I say, by the middle of the year, by July to August. This will be back down to where it was in December.
And yet don't prices always go up around Memorial Day for the summer driving season?
No, no. They don't. It used to be.
All these stories on television are a lie?
It's not a lie. That's what used to happen. But now that spike occurs early in the year as because of formulation changes and the switchover of refineries. And that's, you know, that they'll go up a little bit around the Memorial Day weekend, but they're not going to go up as much as they've gone up this first part of the year.
Meanwhile, despite all of this bad news, the stock market is on a tear. It was $80, 80 points, I think, yesterday, the Dow was at least. What's going on there? Is this irrational exuberance again, or is this
foundation in fact? Mr. Greenspan makes a recovery, yeah. Now, there's probably a little bit of that, but I think there are two factors that are causing this. One is the continuation of really, really monetary easing on the part of the Fed. And, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, you know, if you're getting less than 1% on a CD, that you're going to look for alternatives for return. And the stock market provides that alternative. It's not hard to buy dividend stocks that produce – While your principal is subject to risk, if that stock price can go down, dividend stocks prices don't tend to fluctuate as much as the overall markets do, and it's easy to find 5% dividend producing stocks. And so we've seen a lot of shift over from people who were in CDs moving over to dividend stocks, and that all has an impact of pushing the stock market up. Second thing, so that's monetary easing. It's the Fed policy that is effectively propping up the market. But the second thing is that even despite the weak performance in the economy, the surviving companies coming out of 2008 have figured out how to make money, nice profits for their shareholders, in a what I call the 95% economy, which is kind of what we got left here. Is about economy running about 95% of where we were running before the Great Recession.
And they do that by becoming lean and mean?
Lean and mean, that's right. And they're not investing as much as they used to, et cetera. But they've learned how to make money in this type of environment. And so corporate profits are up. And, you know, that leads to increase in prices.
Now that the stock market is back to – it's above.
It's above. It's historic high.
Yeah. Levels. So, what does that do for consumer confidence? You watch the stock market report. You hear them on Marketplace every night. It's going up and up and up and up. It must make you feel good psychologically, even if you're not invested.
Well, as I heard somebody say yesterday, a colleague of mine, he said, now your 201K is now a 401K again.
and 401.5.
Yeah. But a lot of folks probably gave up looking at their 401K quarterly reports because it made them depressed. So they need to start looking at them again for those that kept money in the market during this period of time. I think that what we're looking at here in terms of consumer confidence is kind of a slow thing. I mean, for one thing, yeah, the market is a positive, but we still have Congress, and it's, you know, it's incredible.
You could have just stopped. We still have Congress.
Yeah, we still have Congress. Okay, I'll leave it at that.
We have to take a break. Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, our guest this hour. Coming right back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, treatment of spine and brain disorders for North Mech and Lake Norman residents at its Huntersville office, neurosurgeons, physiatrists, and physical therapy, CarolinaNeurosurgery.com, and Opera Carolina performing Bizet's The Pearl Fishers April 13th, 18th, and 21st at the Belk Theater. For more information, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. Cyprus seeks alternatives after rejecting European bailout terms. So how the financial crisis in Cyprus is testing Germany, the European Union, and world markets, the topic of the conversation at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to talk about money here, now's your chance with John Connaughton, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
Thinking about a new car with all the latest technology?
You bet I am.
Like ABS and GPS?
I was thinking of, like, doors and windows.
Well, if you're getting rid of a car that's still in good shape, donate it and get a tax break. Call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. John Connaughton, our guest from UNC Charlotte, the Babson Capital Economic Forecast Director. I'm going to go back to the Euro thing and Cyprus for a second, because Larry emails, I don't know if your guest can answer this, but a few years ago there was a bill introduced, H.R. 4646, that would have put a 1% tax on all bank transactions in lieu of federal taxes. What would have happened if this had passed?
Yeah, that was a little different. That's a transaction. So, you know, that what's happening here with the Cyprus is, first of all,
it'd be like a sales tax.
It'd be like a sales tax, yeah. What we're dealing with here, and again, it's a bad – that was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. That was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to bring up, you know, old news, I guess, but, you know, it was kind of in response to the $787 billion TARP fund, mm-hmm. Which – people worth looking at, well, God, taxpayers are bailing out big banks and all the rich people, and this is a bad – well, the fact of the matter is that with a couple of exceptions, and we can talk about those in a minute, all the big banks except for Ally have paid back the federal government with interest on those TARP loans. Federal government's made money. I think the only money that's still outstanding is Ally. There's Fannie and Freddie have some money. Heck, even AIG paid them back. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we've got Chrysler and GM, which the government is an owner in terms of stock. They bought stock, and the stock price is now below what they bought it for. But I think at the end of the day, what we'll see is just like Resolution Trust 20 years earlier, we will see the government actually make money on that. Mm-hmm. So the taxpayers won't be left out in the breeze, if you will. But the idea was let's put a tax on monetary transactions. This actually originated out of Europe. And so what we're dealing with here is kind of the U.S. response to this. It was a bad idea and it didn't go anywhere. But it's subtly different from the confiscation that was contemplated in Cyprus.
We asked our Facebook listeners whether their economic confidence is on the rise. And Wren on Facebook says, my family owns a flower shop in Virginia, and they had the best January and February in the last 4 years, which were abysmal and the worst on record in this 40-plus-year-old business. My mother had been extremely pessimistic, but recently is feeling hopeful. I can feel the good energy in the economy, but for me, the increased price of food has kept me from spending much on discretionary things. Are all these factors at play?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The economy is very complex, but I think that the listener essentially – it's what we're starting to see. She's giving us the same opinion of what we're seeing across a lot of folks, that people are starting to feel like, as I said when we did our press conference last week, you know, I can see a light at the end of the tunnel. I just hope it's actually sunlight and not another train coming, but I'm pretty sure it's sunlight.
Because to back up Wren's mother's experience at her flower shop in Virginia, nationally retail sales jumped unexpectedly in February. Did that happen here?
Yeah. I mean, retail sales are up. I mean, it's despite the fact that everybody took home 2% less than their paycheck in January.
So what is that about?
Two things.
Pent up demand or consumer confidence?
A little bit of pent up demand, but also there are some other things that are going on in the economy as well that we need to talk about. Number one, consumer, in addition to what's going on in the housing market, we've had this period for the last 4 or 5 years where we talked about consumers downsizing, the new normal, and they were what we call deleveraging. Mm-hmm. Okay, they were paying down some of their debt. Well, in the last 5 or 6 months, we've actually started to see consumers start to stop deleveraging and start to increase their debt. So they're going into debt to buy cars. They're going into debt to buy a big screen TV.
Here we go again.
Well, yeah, here we go again. The difference here, Mike, seriously, is they're not using their home equity as their house as an ATM, okay? So they're not refinancing and pulling money out to spend on consumer goods. What we're just seeing is they're just engaging in a car loan. They're just going to Best Buy and buying something.
And that's what's going to – is that what it's going to take to bring us back? Because prior to the recession, we kept talking about that this was a consumer-driven economy. I think it was, what,
70% of GDP is consumption.
Consumption. And then that fell off a cliff because of the recession. And now
because of the recession and deleveraging. And now we're starting to see a return to consumers being willing – and again, this is partly confidence-driven – being willing to engage in debt and buy big-ticket items.
And is that a good thing?
Oh, absolutely a good thing.
Because it's good for the economy?
It creates
is
jobs.
Is what good for the economy good for me?
Yes.
As a citizen?
Yes, it creates jobs.
But then how come we were so woefully moaning about how we're over-leveraged? We got all this credit card debt out there, and people have got to start saving and stop spending prior to the recession.
Right, and we were probably over-leveraged at the peak of this thing. We had a lot of – it could go on forever. It was a bubble, and that's what happens. That's what bubbles do. And so, yeah, we had consumers were over-leveraged, but they have deleveraged, and they're back down into normal ranges. And so when I talk about we start to see consumer debt rising, it's not necessarily per capita debt rising. It's overall debt rising. So we've reached an equilibrium point where consumers are happy with the level of debt they have, and now they're willing to engage in purchases that require them to go into a little bit more debt. And that you put that together, consumer behavior together with what the signs we're seeing in the housing market, and it just says to me anyway that unless something outside the system, some exogenous shock comes in to hit the system, internally the system is on a trajectory for a nice little recovery in the second half of this year on into 2014.
Both the state and the federal government are talking about tax reform. Whether you like Paul Ryan's ideas or you like somebody else's ideas, and then, of course, in the state, they're looking at scrapping the income tax and replacing it with taxes on all kinds of services, among other things. That takes us into an unknown world, doesn't it? Isn't that scary?
It's not scary, but it's probably not the best idea right now to be doing a lot of this stuff because taxes do affect behavior.
But when is it ever going to be a good idea? Because if times are good, you don't want to screw with that, and if times are bad, you don't want to do anything that could make it worse.
The last time we had a significant, and what I mean significant, rewrite of the Internal Revenue Codes was the mid 1980s under Reagan, and we went from 14 marginal brackets that every $2,000 or $3,000 you'd kick up a couple of percent in terms of your marginal tax rate. We went down to what Reagan has a very very simplified tax code. 15% and 28%. That was it. And what they also did was they took all of the deductions that you used to have for state sales tax and all these things. And no, they're gone. They're history. You used to be able to deduct every dollar of employee business expense, any moving expenses, all these kinds. It was all we just had. We had pages and pages of IRS code on deductions. Mm-hmm. They basically wiped most of those out. The only one we kept was
homeowner,
and it was just for the primary home. Now, what we've done in the past 30 years is essentially every time Congress meets, somebody pays for somebody to introduce legislation to get their special treatment back in. And so it's probably time for us to go through and purge again. Economists would argue, and I think you'll find most economists, that any types of special provisions that allow certain deductions versus other industries and consumers that don't get deductions is bad policy because it distorts economic decision making. Mm-hmm. And a great example of that is what's going on in the state right now. We've got a sales tax that's very, very high on a very small part of the economy. About 25% of the economy is subject to sales tax, and 75% is not subject to sales tax. And that disparity distorts economic decision making. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to make the sales tax broader. Now, whether or not you make it broader and reduce the sales tax rate or make it broader and reduce income tax rates, that's a politic item that I'm...
But until they vote on something that makes the change definitive, we have uncertainty. Will they or won't they? And if they do, what will it be? So how is that impacting the economy?
Yeah, again, and when we go back to what Reagan did in the mid-'80s, that was a revenue neutral. And then that was, you know, in those days, mm-hmm. Congress could agree with one another that the tax change would be revenue neutral. But nevertheless, there are winners and losers in that. Absolutely, there are winners and losers. I would like to see them take a look at and kind of reduce the tax codes, both nationally and in the state. But I'd like to see them do it in 2014 once we get a really solid recovery underway. It's a little too early and potentially fragile at this point in time to create more uncertainty in the country.
Because although you heard nothing about it in the run-up in the governor's race or the state legislator races in November, we have a jobs problem in North Carolina. And they didn't talk about it. We talked about it on the national level with the national races, but not here. Why were they so quiet here?
Yeah, it's just their polling suggested that both on the Democratic and Republican side, their polling suggested that it wasn't the big issue in the local elections.
How could it not be? We have enormous unemployment. We're lagging the rest of the country.
Yeah, let's back off for a second. Since January, when McCrory has taken office, it has become very clear that he is focused on this. I was at a speech he gave on January 2nd when he was just governor-elect. He hadn't been inaugurated yet. And, you know, he made the comment that, you know, from an economic development standpoint, North Carolina had lost their mojo. He used those exact terms. He's well aware of it. And, you know, I think that in his administration, jobs will move up in terms of priority, in terms of what it is they will focus on and try to create. And, Mike, if you just look at what's happened in Charlotte in the last month in terms of the job announcements here, it has been quite a fundamental change in job announcements here in terms of new relocations in the since January.
Right.
Versus what happened last year.
So what's the difference? If we lost our mojo prior to the election and prior to Pat McCrory's inauguration as governor, and now we're suddenly beginning to see signs of getting it back, what's going on?
Not statewide. I'm just saying in Charlotte.
Okay.
In Charlotte, Charlotte has done better.
Mecklenburg County region unemployment is pretty high.
It's pretty high, but we've still done better in terms of getting jobs back than the state's done. I mean, up through December, we'd gotten back about 85% of the jobs we lost. So we were really in the local area. We've done fairly well on that. Okay. But the problem we have that's keeping the unemployment rate is that because we are creating jobs here, people are moving in. And so, you know, that increases the labor force as fast as the jobs are being created.
So why did we lose our mojo, and what does that mean, our mojo?
Well, what
went wrong?
What went wrong is that, you know, I would argue that the last couple of administrations have not focused on economic development as their number one priority in the state. They've looked at other things. They've had other issues that they wanted to spend their time, energy, and money on.
Building beach houses, is it?
I'm not going to go into that. Just leave me alone, all right? Give me a break. And as a result of that, we have lost ground to our competitors around us, principally South Carolina. South Carolina has, in the last 10 to 12 years, has been really focused on bringing back manufacturing jobs to the state, been very, very, very successful at it. And as a result, their unemployment rate is much lower than North Carolina's rate. It's in the mid-8% range.
Is that because of incentives they're handing out, because of low taxes in South Carolina, because it's a lower cost of living than North Carolina?
Yes, all of those factors. All of those factors contribute. That's exactly right. Lower taxes, incentives. I mean, it's really that simple. But it's also energy, in the fact that they go out and they do what's necessary in order. The governor's office there believes that's why they're there, is to create jobs for South Carolinians and bring these jobs in, whether they're homegrown or relocation jobs. Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing. Now, unfortunately, there are some things that get left behind in that. Hopefully, when we move forward in terms of economic development, we'll do a little bit more balanced approach, and we won't leave some other government functions behind. But nevertheless, when you're looking at it at this point in time, in terms of what's happened to us in the last 5 years vis-a-vis South Carolina, you know, we haven't had our eye on the ball nearly as efficiently as South Carolina has.
We have a comment from Philip, and we haven't talked about this yet, and that is the airport. We have all these other problems in the state, and the state legislature, or at least the Mecklenburg County delegation, is all in a tizzy about who's going to run the airport. Charlotte has historically run the airport. Charlotte built the airport. Arguably, the airport's done pretty well under Charlotte's tutelage and that of Jerry Orr, because he's kind of left alone to do what he wants out there. But now there are forces that want the airport to be taken over by an airport authority and removed from Charlotte. So what economic impact would that have on the city, on Mecklenburg County? Because the city has no tax revenues go to the airport. Nothing comes out of the airport into the city's coffers. So is it a zero-sum game? Would there be an economic impact?
Let's back up. The Charlotte Airport, and Charlotte, as far as an airport and a hub is concerned, is playing way above its weight class. It's the sixth business airport in the country. At 20-something busiest in the world, right. 700-plus flights, nonstop international destinations that are expanding, not just to Europe but also to South America. It's really way out of its weight class.
When U.S. Airways merges with American, that's all going to get better if they stay here.
If they stay here, that's likely to get better, okay? So we need to understand that. And we don't do it from, domestically generated flights. This is, 75% of the activity in that airport comes from connecting flights.
Right.
All right, so let's back off for a second and ask ourselves a couple of simple questions.
Yeah, 90 seconds.
Yeah, we'll get it in there. One, is the airport an enterprise, an independent enterprise, or is it part of government, subject to the trade-offs that exist between the other services that the city provides? I think that's one issue that's starting those. I think up until recently that was a fairly clear line. It was an enterprise. Mm-hmm. Those issues are starting to get blurred a little bit.
Somebody mentioned that we need money for a streetcar. We might take it from the airport. Is that what you're saying?
There's that. There have been other issues as well. Secondly, when I was beginning my career professionally, a wise gentleman once told me that when you engage in negotiations, the number one thing you need to understand is who holds the hoop and who is jumping through the hoop before you begin negotiations. And I think we need to understand that, yes, the airport is a Charlotte airport, but we do not hold the hoop. The city doesn't hold the hoop.
U.S. Airways holds the hoop?
U.S. Airways or the New American holds the hoop.
So this is not about politics. This is about business.
This is about business. And I think that there are a number of folks in Charlotte that that understand who holds the hoop and believe that an independent authority will be more responsive to future U.S. Air.
So to recap in 5 seconds, you see a bright future for the second half of the year here in North Carolina.
Absolutely, and continuing on into 2014 as well.
Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, the state's official forecast at UNC Charlotte. Thank you again for the hour.
My pleasure.
Mr. Sunshine.